Now, from the left coast to the D.C. Beltway, covering the topics you love to hate and hate to miss, it's the Silk or Joe Show.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Silk or Joe Show. Co-host Joe with you all here this weekend. Always happy to be here with you all. And this show, it's been around for a nice 13 years now, so we want to thank the Main Street Radio Network for allowing this to happen. Wait, why did I say 13 years? It's 12 years. It's in its 13th year. Anyway, so you can go to mainstreetradionetwork.com and show some gratitude. They got a nice contact page there if you want to thank them for this program and all other programming they have, such as the Alan Nathan Show, which is all can be seen at mainstreetradionetwork.com. And you can find podcasts for both programs up there, mainstreetradionetwork.com. And we are also on social media, Facebook at Main Street Radio Network, X at Main Street Radio, X at Alan Nathan, too. I guest host for his show a bunch of times, and you can find information about me guest hosting on X at Alan Nathan. It's a lot more reliable than our own social media page, GetterGETTR.com at Silk or Joe Show, which is solely updated at my pleasure, which is rarely because I do not find social media pleasurable. Anyway, let's get right on to our guest, though. We have joining us now for this opening segment, Gloria Giorno. She is founder of the Reagan Society, founder and president of United Women Foundation, and author of Outcast, How the Radical Left Tried to Destroy a Young Conservative. Gloria Giorno, appreciate you being on the show. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yep, glad to have you. So you have this new book out called Outcast, How the Radical Left Tried to Destroy a Young Conservative. Tell us about it.
Well, my son was student body president at Conservative Christian Belmont University in 2020, and everything was going swimmingly until the 4th of July of 2020, when our son posted on his personal public Instagram page, nothing related to the university. This was his personal Instagram page, a picture of himself in front of the White House, and he thanked our forefathers for our freedoms, which is what the 4th of July stands for. We saw nothing wrong with it. It was met with 300 comments, mostly negative. Go kill yourself. You're a bad person. And the next day, there was a change.org petition citing our son as being a racist, celebrating a covertly racist holiday.
Well, that might explain the drive for Juneteenth, even though that isn't the end of slavery. Yeah. It's proximate to the 4th of July, and they label it as Black Independence Day. But still, you're talking about your son going to a conservative university, yet he still faced all this backlash for posting something about the 4th of July and the Founding Fathers, who themselves were actually split on the issue of slavery.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's exactly true. And so it got to the point where our son... This is 2020, so our son could not, it was COVID, so the whole world had gone a little crazy, but our son was actually getting death threats. So his fraternity, the only fraternity on campus, told him that he needed to also endorse BLM, and if he did not endorse BLM, they would destroy him. Well, there's no way that our son was going to endorse a Marxist organization. I grew up in a communist country. My son's cousin was a Chicago police officer who was killed in the line of duty in 1995. There was no way that our son was ever going to endorse BLM. He was not going to post that black square. So he left his fraternity. But the university, yes, a conservative Christian university, the fraternity, every organization on campus did endorse BLM. Ultimately, our son, they did open up school again at some point in late September, and ultimately he was escorted by a police officer when on campus, and his car was not allowed to be anywhere near the university. So the university took the side of the left instead of doing the right thing.
And again, that's a conservative university, so that just proves how malicious and pernicious this left-wing ideology has become, where even a conservative university is just so terrified that they, and the student body seems to be opposed as well, that such a threat that your son needed a police escort for saying something good about the Founding Fathers.
It's terrifying, but this indoctrination has been going on in our country for probably 30 to 40 years. And until COVID, I don't think parents knew what was exactly being taught at schools. And it's not just the university level. It starts way before that. But on a university level, our son did turn in everything as he was supposed to three separate entities at the university. This is Tennessee. So we were able to record one party consent state. We were able to record everything. We were able to keep document absolutely everything that went back and forth. And so that's why we decided, instead of going public with a lawsuit, we decided to write a book. So that's how the book came about. But in no world should any child have to be escorted by a police officer on any college campus. It is wrong across the board. And what I noticed is that Belmont University paralleled what I grew up in communist Yugoslavia. Our son was basically silenced.
And the stunning thing is, though, Yugoslavia, that's actually held up as an example of more moderate communism, more moderate socialism.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that went on there. So, and the people that you at the universities who are kind of pushing on this, and the teachers in our regular education system that are pushing this, they want to go way beyond Yugoslavia.
Yes, way beyond. You're right. Yugoslavia was a very modern communist country, but I can tell you there was nothing. It was nothing like that, but that's what it was termed as. When I lived there, I was 6 years old. I went to a U.S. Embassy school, first grade. I had $1,000 in my backpack every single day on my way to school or anywhere I went, because at the age of six, my parents taught me how to get out of that country in case of a civil war, because there is no peace, there is no certainty in a communist country. And I did see police officers every day, but I knew that they were not there to protect me. The police officers are there to make sure that no one speaks out against the communist regime. They are there to protect the dictator. At the time, it was Josip Broz Tito. I also knew that if I needed to see a doctor, it would be a long wait. I had chickenpox when I was 6 years old, and a pharmacist diagnosed me. There is no such thing as free medicine. There is no such thing as free schools. There is no capitalism. You cannot be what you want to be. You have to be what the government dictates you will be. You do what they want you to do with your life. There is no freedom. There is no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of, there is no Second Amendment right. They take away your guns. They take away your liberties.
Yeah, and it keeps them in power. And I guess that's the only time that a leftist would trust the police, is if they were in a dictatorial regime like that. And it's a sad thing that we're seeing that elsewhere, and not surprisingly in some parts of the U.S., where the police seem more inclined to enforce, you know, progressive agendas. Like I'm thinking California, for example. They don't go after thieves. They hardly go after an armed robber. But I remember videos coming out the year before last, where some guy just had not even a complete AR, just part of a lower receiver in his house, and like 10 police officers showed up to make sure it was in acceptable condition under California law. It's like, what are you guys doing there? There's all these crimes going on elsewhere that they're not bothering with.
I agree. I'm originally from Chicago, so I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, hey, what's going on in Chicago? I mean, we're allowing criminals to walk the streets. We're allowing illegal students to attend universities at no charge. Undocumented citizens get to go to school for free while you and I pay for our children to attend university. I mean, Illinois has the same issues. The crime issue in Chicago is outrageous, yet they keep electing, they keep voting for the same people in office, and we're making no changes. Something needs to change before we have a communist mayor in every city. And we all have a front row seat to New York City now, and we'll see what happens next month. And my heart breaks for New Yorkers who do not understand, especially young women who voted for the new mayor. Breaks my heart, but they're going to be in for a rude awakening. Free groceries have already been taken off the shelf, as you have heard. So we will all have a front row seat to communism in this country, and God willing, no one else will vote for it in this country.
Well, going to that, I think part of the problem, too, with Mamdani is some of the stuff he wanted to do, he can't do without the New York State legislature's approval. And if that ends up being the case, then he ends up making empty promises until the whole state is communist. And then at that point, they can implement their agenda. And then it's not just New York City, it's the whole state. But then by then, you know, it's kind of too late for New York State, because there doesn't seem to be any going back from the precipice of communism.
That's a very scary thought, because it will spread. You're right. It'll spread to California. It'll spread to Illinois. It'll spread to other states. But that's a very scary thought. But if we do not fight back as conservatives right now, we will lose our country. And once we lose America, that's it. We're done. We have nowhere else to go. I mean, that's it. So that's why I feel very strongly that for the midterms, every Republican, every conservative needs to speak out, needs to vote. It's so important that we keep a margin, a good margin for President Trump in Congress. Right now, Tennessee had the election for former Congressman Mark Green's seat, and we did have a communist Democrat female running, and she was running against a combat veteran, Matt Van Epps, and he did win by 9 points, which I know a lot of people say it's not a good margin, but considering it was a special election, it was the only election in the country at that time, Matt did very well, and it was very quick, and he ran a very clean, excellent campaign, and 9 points is all we needed, and we won, and we just need to keep that going, but we need to reach out to women. Young women are the ones who need to be educated more than anyone else. Men are on board with the truth. They understand it, but young women, unfortunately, do not.
All right, well, that's a sound pitch for your group, United Women Foundation. We got about 20 seconds left. Where can listeners find more information about it?
Actually, thereagansociety.com is your best place to find us.
Okay. Well, listeners, you can go check out thereagansociety.com. We're coming to a break, but we've got more Silk or Joe Show coming up.
Next year marks America's 250th birthday. And what better way to celebrate than an elevated train journey through the American Southwest? Canyon Spirit offers the adventure of a lifetime with scenic train journeys through rugged canyons and desert landscapes, along with gourmet dining and world-class service. Expansive panoramic windows allow guests to watch the magnificent scenery best seen by rail, including river canyons, red rocks, and more. Canyon Spirit travels between Salt Lake City and Denver with overnight stays in Moab, Utah, and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And the train only travels during the day, allowing guests to enjoy the journey and relax overnight in charming small towns. TV host and travel expert Kelly Rizzo.
I think there's a certain romance to boarding a train, especially through the iconic vistas of the Southwest. Canyon Spirit offers a front row seat to these breathtaking wonders, along with historic storytelling and regionally inspired gourmet dining. It's truly a wondrous experience.
To learn more, visit canyonspirit.com.
Saving Gotham City is serious business, but family comes first in an all-new DC animated series now streaming on Prime Video. Batfam reveals Batman in a whole new light. At home, taking care of a newly formed family, which may be even tougher than fighting crime. Batman, Alfred, and young Damian Wayne are joined by a few new residents to Wayne Manor, including Alfred's free-spirited grandniece Alicia and a recently reformed supervillain named Clay. Together, this very unique family faces the challenges of daily life while protecting the streets of Gotham City. Executive producer and showrunner Mike Roth.
I think kids will enjoy seeing Batman at home, taking care of the cat, setting up family game night, and just being a dad. The show has lots of action, big laughs, and plenty of heart as this group of misfits come together to form a family.
Don't miss Batfam, now streaming on Prime Video, because this time, justice will be served family style.
The holidays are a time for celebration, and for many that means indulging in delicious foods that are often high in fat and cholesterol. But for people living with uncontrolled high LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, too much of these foods can further increase LDL-C and increase risk for heart attack or stroke. Besides diet and exercise, many people take statins to maintain healthy LDL-C levels, but even that may not be enough for some. Registered dietitian Leanne Bloden is VP and Head of Clinical Development at Esperion.
Statins are the standard of care in cholesterol management, but may not be enough or may not be tolerable for patients who have what is called statin intolerance. Alternative medications are available to help people who cannot take statins at all or at recommended levels. Patients dealing with statin intolerance can ask their healthcare provider about alternative medications to help manage their high bad cholesterol and reduce the risk of a heart attack or stroke, not only during the holidays, but all year long.
Visit statinalternatives.info to learn more.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at pva.org.
Welcome back to the Silk and Joe Show, everybody. Co-host Joe with y'all here this weekend, and we are joined now by Inez Stepman. She is a senior policy and legal analyst with the Independent Women's Voice. She is a Lincoln Fellow with the Claremont Institute and a senior contributor to the Federalist, with her work appearing in outlets such as USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and New York Post. Inez Stepman, appreciate you being on the show. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
Yep, glad to have you. So New York City right now, they're bracing for the reign of their socialist mayor. He seems a little bit limited in his promises, though, because state law and probably federal law in some cases would have to change. But what can they do about what to fight back against what he can do to them?
Well, so as you say, he is limited on certain of his promises. In fact, I would say that I'm less worried about the economic side of his reign as a New Yorker. Not that he couldn't make changes that would cause an exodus of high earners or businesses who don't want to be part of his socialist vision, or rather the butt of it. But that takes more time, and it would take a lot more cooperation from Albany. And I think he's not going to be able to effectuate that in the same way. What I do worry about is the mayor's immediate ability to have a very deleterious effect on public safety. I mean, that's really the part of his agenda that I think he can implement very quickly. He just hired, as part of his transition team, one of the main academics behind the vision of abolishing police and abolishing prisons altogether. So he's not backing down too much from that part of his platform, and that's the part I'm the most worried about day to day, honestly.
And he doesn't seem alone in that. I remember reading last night the Chicago mayor, Brandon Johnson, was talking about how they need to find something other than incarceration to handle violent offenders. So if Mamdani has that idea, New York City being a bigger city, that's going to be a bigger problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have the idea that New York is incredibly dangerous. But in 2019, New York was incredibly safe for an American city. I mean, I just remember being able to walk everywhere at 4 a.m. with headphones on in Manhattan, right? It's not to say there was no crime in the city, but it was very, very well managed after an era that started with Giuliani. So they started off as a very safe city. It got much worse, as many cities did, through the 2020s and then into the last few years. We already were seeing some climb out from a bottom. With the last couple years of Eric Adams, but it would be very easy for New York to go off a cliff in the wrong trajectory. And a lot of Mondani's policies are really poised to have us do that. As you mentioned, he's buddy-buddy with a bunch of people who don't even believe that incarceration is the appropriate response to people who are repeatedly violent. So that's where he could have the most effect. I mean, he can pull the cops out of the subways today or tomorrow, as soon as he actually takes power, and that would be very, very bad for the city and for everybody, including myself, who takes public transit in the city. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it here. I think his mayorship will be really, really bad for New York City, but some of his grander economic visions, I just don't see him having the help from the state and especially the feds to implement.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that the people who voted for him may have either not been around or forgotten how bad New York City can get. You know, talking about the 70s and the 80s New York City, which Mamdani's policies would bring them back to. And I mean, I remember the other day I was watching the series finale for MASH that the late Alan Nathan had taped off of the TV when it aired, and they had to run commercials advertising New York City to try and attract tourists there. So that's just how bad things got, that New York City needed commercials to attract people there because of how bad things were, and now you have these people voting because they've forgotten that era.
Yeah, well, a lot of Mondami's voters, it's interesting, some of the polling and exit polling that has come out since his victory, he's really seen together a coalition of, on the one hand, downwardly mobile, overly educated, liberal, progressive voters, many of them disproportionately in their 20s, and by the way, disproportionately recent transplants to the city of New York. So the more years you've spent above 10 and then above 20 and then since you were born and for the real native New Yorkers, they mostly voted for Cuomo and even some for Sliwa. They really did not go for Mondami. He was sort of the candidate of this this class of I call them the master's class, like as a joke, but these are people with a lot of higher degrees. They work for nonprofits in the city, or they work in HR in some of these, you know, industries in New York, and they've only been there for a few years, and they come from other parts of the country. So anyway, that's one huge part of Mondami's base, and it's the part that's gotten a lot of coverage, and I think all of that coverage is more or less correct. The part that has had, I think, a little less coverage is that that base was seems to me to be the first flexing of a politically organized Islam in America. And by that, I want to be really clear. I don't think that Mondami is an Islamist. I don't think he takes his religion very seriously. I think he uses his religion as a kind of chit in the progressive game of oppression. So he says, oh, I'm Muslim and brown, you know, 2 points, right? So it's not that his beliefs in itself are so extreme, but if you looked at the campaign that he ran, including posing with a radical imam who was the unindicted co-conspirator in the 93 World Trade Center bombing, including the exchange he had with Andrew Cuomo in the debate, in the last debate, where he basically fired back at Cuomo and said, well, you're not visiting mosques the same way that a Democratic candidate is expected, for example, to do the rounds of the black organized black churches in New York and in many other cities. I think what we're seeing is this recent, in the last 10 or 15 years, explosion of Muslim migration and settlement in New York City, to the point where I was surprised to discover that there are almost as many Muslims as Jews in New York, just because Jews are so identified with New York City that sometimes, hopefully affectionately, it's known as Jew York City. And there are almost as many Muslims now. And that's a very recent immigration development. And I think we're seeing for the first time with Mondami's election, the flexing of that political block in New York's long history of ethnic politics. And I just look to London for where that direction goes if it continues, I think. So in that sense, I don't dismiss the rhetoric around Islamism in this election, not because I think Mondami himself is an Islamist, but because I think the second piece of his voting bloc that got him into power is the first example in a major U.S. city, I think, at least of the size of something like, you know, in New York, like a first-tier city, of politically organized Islam, like every other ethnic organized bloc in New York. So, I'm worried about where the direction of that kind of politics in the city, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can kind of see, I think Minneapolis, they're much smaller than New York City, but they're a little farther along with the Islamists taking over. I mean, their recent election this year, I read that for mayor, that the candidate for mayor, they had to drop the Somali because the Somali tribes couldn't unite around him. And, you know, we're talking about one of the hotbeds of terrorism production in the U.S., too, with all the fraud going on. I mean, would we see New York City becoming that?
Yeah, I mean, potentially. So there, I was kind of shocked to discover this myself. But so in the 90s and early 2000s, there's not great data on this, but the best data we have says that there were, you know, in the tens of thousands, maybe not even 100,000 Muslims in New York City. Now there, it's about 9% of the city. It's between 800,000 and 900,000. So
we'll have to leave that there. But if you could stick around for the next segment, we can get more into this.
Gather to celebrate. The Army Reserve is proud to reaffirm our commitment to those who serve and those who support them. Command Sergeant Major Gregory Betty shares more.
The Army Reserve supports our nation and invests in the future of our warrior citizens each and every day. Our soldiers remain combat ready to respond to today's ever-changing challenges with world-class training and career opportunities. The Army Reserve remains focused on building a stronger, more connected community. From the U.S. Army Reserve, happy holidays to all soldiers, families, civilians, and the communities that support us. Wherever you are this season, thank you for your service and dedication. Wishing you a joyful, safe, and peaceful holiday. Twice a citizen, combat ready, this will defend.
Visit usar.army.mil to learn more about the Army Reserve.
Cold and flu season is here, and families are searching for natural ways to support immunity. Roxana Asani, registered dietitian and nutritionist, has more.
Herbal remedies help strengthen the body's natural defenses for daily resilience and energy, so you're ready for whatever the season brings.
For adults, that means stronger immunity and steady energy to keep up with work and family. For kids, it's about gentle, safe support parents can feel good about during the school year.
Not all immune support products are created equal. Look for quality-tested options with trusted ingredients. Immune and Energy for adults blends astragalus, ashwagandha, Siberian ginseng, and reishi. For kids ages 3 to 12, our Immune Daily Syrup features clinically researched herbs and raspberry flavor with zero sugar.
Harker Herbals, New Zealand's leading natural wellness company, has been making herbal remedies for 45 years. Now their immune and wellness products are available in the U.S. on Amazon and harkerherbals.com.
Butterball, the best known and most loved brand of turkey in the U.S., has partnered with renowned Chef Corps brand Headley and Bennett to create the first ever Thanksgiving hosting pans. Butterball turkey talk line expert Corey Gustavik shares more.
Roasting whole turkey isn't something most of us do every day. It can be intimidating and stressful, but the right clothes can make you feel more confident and comfortable in the kitchen. That's why Butterball created the first of their kind Thanksgiving hosting pants. Designed with a fun turkey print in Butterball blue, these pants are sure to give you swagger in the kitchen while keeping all your cooking essentials within arm's reach. With custom pockets for your meat thermometer and phone, loops for your utensils and towels, and a bottle opener to keep the party hydrated, these pants will help you get a leg up in your hosting duties this year. Butterball is giving away for free one final time while supplies last at noon Eastern this Monday, November 17th.
Learn more and claim your pair of hosting pants at ThanksgivingHostingPants.com.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
This forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Silker Joe Show, everybody, and we appreciate our guest, Dina Stepman, for staying on for this segment as well. She is a senior policy and legal analyst with Independent Women's Voice. Now, at the tail end of the last segment, we were talking about the rapid rise of the Islamic population in New York City. Could you give us those figures again? We kind of got cut off by the break there.
Yeah, so New York City's population of Muslims in the late 90s or early 2000s, from the best data that I could find, was somewhere on the order of tens of thousands. And now it's between 800,000 and 900,000. So you're talking about something like a 9- to 10-fold increase in the Muslim population just in the last 20 to 25 years. And that's that's huge, right? I think it's a story that's gone under the radar. And obviously, when you have 9% of the city, especially if that community is able to hold as a voting block, I think that they will make a substantial impact on New York City's politics. And I think Mondami's election is probably the first example of that, even though he himself is relatively secular and buys into even all the left's shibboleths about LGBTQ or you know, plans to spend $65 million of taxpayer money on sex change surgeries, right? The second piece of the coalition that elected him, besides those young progressives, was this growing block of Muslim voters who are starting to make their voice heard in the city. And some may say, what's wrong with that? You know, other ethnic blocks have done the same in New York City's long history. But I think that it's different when you have a population that in many cases has a religious and cultural outlook that is not only fully foreign to the United States, but antithetical to the sort of Judeo-Christian foundations of the West. So, you know, I it's something to keep an eye on is all I would say about the future of New York City's politics. This bloc exists. They flex their political muscle for the first time. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next several elections, it becomes just a standard Democratic Party practice in New York and in other cities that may be heading the same way to campaign in the Islamic community and in mosques in the same way that we've become used to Democratic politicians, for example, campaigning in the Black Church organization or, you know, Republicans going around to various, you know, branches of Protestant Christianity in the South, right? Like, I just, this will become part of our ethnic and religious politics. And I think it behooves us then to think about, you know, how we might want to rethink some of our immigration and migration policies if we don't want a large Muslim and potentially Islamist bloc in some of our major cities that really substantially affects the politics.
Yeah, and even leftists should be taking note of this after some recent events with that, because was it in 2023, Hamtramck, I think that's how it's pronounced, Hamtramck, for some reason it ends with a CK instead of just a K or a C, city in Michigan. They were celebrating how the Muslim majority city elected an all Muslim city council. And the first thing they did was ban pride flags during Pride Month from being displayed in the city. I guess you could put them on your private property, but it's not going to be on any city property. It's not going to be on the streets. It's not going to be anywhere. And you know, the LGBTQ activists were complaining they felt betrayed. How dare you do this to us? We helped put you into office, and the first thing you do is ban our symbols from being displayed. So we're seeing kind of disruption of the intersectionality that unites the left with this sort of thing. And there was another case too, I think it was 2023 as well, earlier in the year. It was in Northern Virginia somewhere, Fairfax or Loudoun County, where this Islamic woman went up before the school board and blasted them for their LGBTQ curriculum, saying this is not compatible with the faith of my kid. And, you know, we want some leeway. You talk about all this tolerance. Where's the tolerance for our faith?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an obvious contradiction between these two bedfellows, but I think it would be a mistake. It's so easy to mock, right, when you say, especially to bring it back to New York, there are protests, the pro-Palestinian protests, there are kind of two wings of the pro-Palestinian protests, right? One is in Bay Ridge, which is a big Palestinian community in the city, and those are a lot of, you know, angry-looking young men parading around in a very aggressive manner. You go over to the West Village in Manhattan, and it's Queers for Palestine, right? And fashionably draped keffiyehs over, like, crop tops. And there's an obvious contradiction in those two halves of the coalition, but it's a mistake, I think, to think that they will not work together against a common enemy, which is, in many cases, America itself, Western values, the Judeo-Christian foundations of this country's culture. I think that they will find themselves, even as uncomfortable bedfellows, I think they'll find themselves two halves of a coalition that, at least with Mondami's election in New York, has notched its first major victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the only question will be, how united will they remain after their victory? Once that common foe is vanquished, you know, who decides now which side wins?
Yeah, well, I think they think that's a problem for another day, but they you're right that they may find it, it may be after, like, the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which was the original revolution to get out the Shah, of course, was, you know, very much supported by socialists and leftist intellectuals, very secular parts of Tehran, and then they quickly found themselves in a non-negotiating position with the Shah, with the Islamic Revolution and with the new Islamic rules of the country. So yeah, I mean, I guess we on the right can take some small comfort that if they vanquish us, like, at least eventually they'll get their comeuppance. But I'd rather not see that happen in America.
Right. Yeah. No one wants to get to that point. You know, it's like when people say, "Oh, it's New York City. Who cares?" Well, you should care, because first of all, it's happening in a city in America. Why would you want that sort of thing to happen anywhere in the U.S.? But also, if it's happening there, you know, the people who allowed it to happen, they are on their soil. They're going to move to somewhere else, vote the same way that they've been voting this whole time, and it's going to happen somewhere else. It's not a just isolated event. What happens in New York will affect everyone else.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, unfortunately, this is not, especially when you're talking about the migration patterns, it's not exclusive to New York. You mentioned Minnesota, you mentioned Dearborn, Michigan is another one of these places. So, you know, right now, I think in the entire country, there's something like 1.5 percentage points that are Muslim. But if you're concentrated in a geographical area, you can affect policy quite substantially. And that's what we're seeing in these isolated cities. And now this is like the first time it's jumped from a relatively small city that can have numbers that are easily overwhelmed to, wow, we're talking about 9% of New York City, the biggest city in America, right? So I think it really does. It's kind of an astounding commentary on American tolerance that Muslim immigration has gone up by such an amazing extent after 9/11 that people were so, you know, rightly reluctant to ascribe the views of the hijackers and the people who murdered 3,000 Americans to their Muslim neighbors. Now, that's good and right. People should be trusted, you know, should be treated as individuals. But the idea that the country, after that kind of Islamic attack, would increase Muslim immigration by potentially, you know, 5 or 10 times is a level of suicidal tolerance, I think. So even though it shows something good about Americans and their hearts, I think this is a problem that we should be explicitly talking about. We don't want to end up like Europe. We don't want to find out that major, you know, Islamic migration has essentially changed the map of our cities and potentially our country in a way that perhaps lower numbers of immigrants or people who really want to come here individually and assimilate do not.
Right. I was, you know, Paris has its no-go zones because the police are just too afraid of Islamic retribution if they try and enforce the law there. Sharia courts are happening in London, and there's the grooming gangs in England in general that are going about because of their unfettered, unvetted Islamic immigration. Unfortunately, it can be pinned on those groups and just how those cultures that they're coming from treat women. And, you know, they're not seemingly westernizing, they're just balkanizing. They're coming in and creating a colony rather than trying to assimilate. And the attitude of leftists is, so what, it's a good thing we have all these diverse cultures, but like, we don't have unifying values.
Yeah, it's funny because there's almost a contradiction. The people who want to insist that America is purely an idea, it's totally disconnected from the actual population of people who started this country and built its culture and its foundations, and that would be white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, mostly British and a few other European nationalities. And I say this as somebody, my parents are immigrants from Poland and I'm half Jewish, okay? But you have to recognize the group of people who built the norms of this country, the cultures of this country, the institutions of this country. There's a big difference between saying, we're not completely closed, that individuals can come and assimilate to these ideas. But when you start to talk about mass populations, it would be foolish to imagine, for example, if there existed 300 million Frenchmen, which they don't, maybe fortunately, but there are 300 million Frenchmen who came to the United States, that America wouldn't become much, much more French overnight. When you're talking about the level of mass populations, you change the country and the culture very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ina Stepman, I appreciate you being on the Silk Road Joe Show to talk about this. We've got about 15 seconds left. Where can our listeners find more of your work?
You can find a lot of my writing at The American Mind, something run by the Claremont Institute, and then you can find the rest of my work at IWF.org.
All right, listeners, you can check that out. We're at a break, but we're still Silker Joe on the other side.
Prime Video introduces June Farms, a charming new unscripted series filled with love, drama, and farms. June Farms, which sits on 120 acres in New York's beautiful Hudson Valley, is a well-known destination for high-end weddings and events. The farm hosts eccentric locals, well-heeled travelers, and occasional celebrities who come for the unique accommodations and incredible service. But sometimes not everything goes as planned. Demanding guests, unpredictable weather, vendor mishaps, and a property full of animals can all wreak havoc on the farm's intricately planned events. June Farms owner Matt Baumgartner.
This is a high-stress job to say the least, especially during wedding season. But despite the chaos, my employees and I all come together, kind of like a weird, dysfunctional family, and create magical memories that last a lifetime. I think viewers will enjoy getting a look at what happens behind the curtains and how, incredibly, everything seems to fall into place.
Don't miss June Farms, now streaming on Prime Video.
Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is a common, contagious, and potentially serious virus that can affect the lungs and breathing passages. GSK's Sideline RSV campaign is highlighting the risks for older adults, especially those with certain chronic conditions. With more, here's Dr. Leonard Friedland from GSK.
Each year, about 177,000 adults 65 and older are hospitalized in the U.S. with RSV. Adults aged 50 to 74 with chronic lung or heart disease, complicated diabetes, or weakened immune systems, and all adults 75 and older are at increased risk for severe illness.
Vaccination is available to help prevent severe RSV.
It's essential to understand your risks. Older adults should talk to their doctor or pharmacist about RSV and ask if vaccination is right for them. Taking proactive steps now can help prevent severe illness later.
For more information and resources, visit sidelinersv.com.
The Medicare annual enrollment period runs each year from October 15th through December 7th, and it's an important time of year for the millions of Americans who already enjoy Medicare coverage. It's their chance to compare plan options for 2026. We know that Medicare coverage can be confusing. One thing I recommend to help navigate through the process is really focus on two things: cost and coverage. For cost, you want to consider things like the plan's premium, deductibles, copay or coinsurance. And for coverage, you should look not only at the medical coverage, things like hospital and doctor visits, but also prescription drug coverage and any extra benefits. The annual enrollment period runs from October 15th through December 7th. It's a great time to compare those cost and coverage of the plans available. Lots of options to consider for your Medicare choices in 2026. To help you navigate, I would recommend starting with a visit to MedicareEducation.com.
My name is Judy Teeter, and I'm the mother of three boys. My youngest, Joe, was a great kid. He loved sports, music, and his youth group. One day, Joe asked me to drive him to an after-school event, which was about a mile from our home. I was driving through a green light when a car in cross traffic ran a red light and drove right into the side of our car, killing Joe. The driver was talking on her phone, so she never even saw the red light. She was so absorbed in her phone call. Before the crash, I didn't realize just talking on a cell phone while driving was so dangerous. Now it's something I think about every day. According to the National Safety Council, about 1 in 4 car crashes involves a cell phone. Hands-free is no safer. When you're behind the wheel, put away your phone. For Joe and for the thousands of needless deaths every year. Remember, there is no safe way to talk on a cell phone while driving. Find out more at nsc.org/callskill.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all gotta help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're going to be saving our lives. To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
And this is something that he's been pushing for, arguably, for the past 7.5 years. And when you talk to the president, you hear him talk, he thinks that this is one of the most significant aspects of his legacy, that he has done something that unites the world around the goal of saving the planet. Now, as a practical matter, it's very interesting that this is happening on a day when there's a hurricane bearing down on the United States and in the Caribbean, because these severe storms, beach erosion, intense weather episodes that we've had are perhaps the most practical example of what the president is talking about as the threat that the planet faces. And this is what this whole climate agreement, signed by 190 nations and now ratified by about 60 or so, is designed to stop.
Beth, I'd play that blast from the past. It was from October 5th, 2016 on MSNBC, from MSNBC's Life with Kate Snow, and NBC's Ron Allen was reporting on President Obama. That was the president he was talking about, President Obama, and how he was pushing for the Paris Climate Agreement for 7.5 years as part of his legacy. And then Ron Allen says that the timing of the agreement to coincide with the hurricane is fitting because the agreement is designed to stop hurricanes and other severe weather. And it seems that might have worked, because here's this headline over at newsbusters.org. Shocker, hurricane climate disaster the media said was coming this year never happened. So I guess Obama's Paris Climate Agreement finally worked. So let's now talk about this. We have Joseph Vasquez. He is an associate editor at the Media Research Center's Free Speech America and MRC Business. Joseph Vasquez, happy to have you on the show. How are you today?
I'm doing well, my friend. Thanks for having me.
Yep, glad to have you. So what do you make of this doom and gloom that we were told about the hurricane season only for it to not materialize? Is it any different from, what, 8 years, no, 9 years ago now when we were told that the Paris Climate Agreement would get rid of hurricanes?
If I were just to put in a one-liner, the so-called media experts who are predicting how hurricane season is going to be are about as accurate as someone trying to predict the weather for tomorrow. You don't know squat. And that's exactly what happened. They were trying to drum up fears from months ago that we were going to have above normal activity, that there could possibly be multiple hurricanes making landfall and whatever, only to find out, hey, guess what? We went through hurricane season without any U.S. landfall for the first time in 10 years, right? So now the media has got a bunch of egg on their face because they were preaching doom and gloom before. I mean, some outlets were saying, oh, homeowners, you know, start getting your insurance now, start saving now because disaster is coming. But then all of a sudden, like in retrospect, you see, they were lying straight through their teeth. They had no idea what was going to happen. And that's the ultimate farce of anyone who claims to be a climate change activist, thinking that they are some sort of seer who could see into a crystal ball and predict what the future is going to hold. It's nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess they're relying on the short-term memory of the American people to forget that, oh, yeah, they actually said we should all be dead by now from all these hurricanes, but then we didn't even get a hurricane.
Yeah, but as you said, it seems like the Paris Climate Accord finally worked. Apparently, we figured out a way to control hurricanes now. Wow. Interesting plot twist.
And I guess it's not going to stop them, though, being so incredibly wrong. And no one's going to remember, you know, at the beginning of hurricane season next year when they make the same predictions that, oh, yeah, they did it last year and nothing happened.
Oh, no, they're shameless. They're going to continue to do this every single year. Why? Because ultimately there is an ulterior motive involved. Because if you can push this idea that man is causing all of this climate change to go around, guess what? You can use that as a springboard to just launch all of these regulatory pushes to completely constrict the U.S. economy, you know, to the degree that they want to shift it towards a more green, friendly environment. And that's the ultimate agenda. It's not about dealing with the natural disasters, it's about a political agenda, and that's what they've been doing for years. This is just the case in point. They were trying to say, oh, look, you know, the experts are saying that we're going to be facing some sort of cataclysmic event, vis-a-vis hurricanes in the next few months, only to find out, hey, guess what? You guys literally don't know anything about what's going to happen in the future, so stop making it seem like you guys are some sort of doom prophet who has any kind of accuracy or legitimacy to begin with. It's complete nonsense.
And just the wealth of things that they do blame climate change on. I live in an area that should have been affected by hurricanes this season on the coast of Virginia. And the local news, instead of focusing on the lack of that, they instead were talking about how all these beach houses on the Outer Banks of North Carolina were starting to collapse into the sea because of beach erosion, which they were tying to man-made climate change. But, like, this is a barrier island. The darn thing is supposed to be shifting. We have no idea what it looked like 500 years ago, 800 years ago. And yet they're telling us that this is definitely humans causing the beach to erode like that, when that's kind of the whole point of the beach to begin with, that it is there to be eroded. It probably got there to begin with from erosion.
Exactly. And in the end, you know, you summed it up perfectly. It's just conjecture. I mean, you know, I mean, CNN, you know, was even coming out, I mean, on the hurricane thing, a headline from about a few months ago. They said primetime hurricane season is here and the Atlantic Ocean is a powder keg. You would think like some sort of like cataclysmic explosion is about to go off in the Atlantic. I mean, but that's the kind of narrative that they push. They want you to see climate change in your soup. You're eating a certain kind of soup, you're contributing to climate change. Your dog is contributing to climate change. Your cow is contributing to climate change. Everything somehow gets tied to climate change. Climate change is somehow the root of every kind of so-called American evil. That's what's so ridiculous about this whole thing. It's just a tool to get people to kowtow to a leftist political regulatory agenda. That's all it is, and that's all it ever will be.
And it's a poor reflection on the poor education in our schools, where people aren't realizing, well, wait a minute, the climate's been changing like the entirety of Earth's history. How do we know that this is something humans are doing versus what the Earth would have done on its own?
Exactly. I mean, like, if you want to look back in history, I mean, you look back in history, there have been periods in Earth's history where the oxygen levels or the atmospheric levels were drastically different from the way that they are right now. And it was a lot more toxic of an environment. I mean, so guess what? The climate has always been changing. It always will change. Nothing will stop it from changing. The question is, how does humanity adapt? And we've shown our ability to adapt in and through every season. So the same way that the climate was like 100 years ago, we adapted to that. We're going to adapt the way that it is to the way it is now. Bjorn Lomborg has made this point again and again and again. The key to dealing with any kind of climate change, quote unquote, is innovation through capitalism, through the innovation of different technologies and devices. To be able to do that, not through massive regulatory agendas that you tell people, no, you cannot use this anymore, you know, and you have to get stuck with high prices for the purpose of maintaining climate virtue. It's nonsense, and it's just tyranny at its finest.
Yeah, and there's also a certain irony underlying it, where you're saying we're going to stop the climate from changing, which is itself a form of man-made climate change.
Exactly. That's the thing. I mean, consistency's not a strong point with the left. They'll continue to push out these contradictory statements and just reveal the own hubris underlying all of it. It is nonsense.
All right. Well, Joseph Vasquez, appreciate you being on the Silk or Joe Show to talk about this. Where can our listeners find more of your work?
You find my work at newsbusters.org. My stuff gets posted on the business section there. Follow me. We're going to hold this climate change rabble to account. Let's do it.
All right. Well, listeners, you can go check all that out. We're done with you for today. But our website is mainstreetmedianetwork.com. Be seeing you.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.